I've got a video, and I'm just going to go ahead and say now, though, all the kids are gone. Okay, it's not really scary, but let's go ahead and roll this video, and then we'll get started.
AMC's The Walking Dead returns with new episodes this February.
The whole town is out on the street.
You and I could end this tonight.
I need to go see them. He's gone.
I'm not sure where her loyalties lie.
What the hell is he doing?
You should stop.
Stop what?
Meeting the leader.
AMC's The Walking Dead returns this February.
Get back here!
For a longer look, go to amctv.com.
Whoa. That's tonight, baby. Yeah. Anybody here excited about the season and half premiere? Yeah. It's going to be awesome. So, by the way, if you have cable and would like to invite me over so I don't have to wait like 3 weeks for someone to upload it to YouTube. Oh, yeah. Okay. $1.99? That's so worth it. Best $1.99 you're going to spend all week right there. Yeah, if you haven't gotten hooked on this show, it's a great show. The Walking Dead is a zombie show. I tried to pick a promo for the season and a half premiere that wasn't too gruesome and gory because I didn't know if the kids were going to be in here. But who is just any zombie show people? Like, you just like zombie shows in general? You guys are weird because I don't, man. I'm just like,
I have nightmares about zombies.
And you watch the shows. Okay, how many see the root of this problem? No. I love this show, and this is really, it's a brilliant, it's kind of really swept the nation. It's on AMC, so obviously it's a network that probably never really dreamed that they would have the kind of success that they've had with this show. I mean, it's really, it's a buzz, and people are talking about the premiere for second part of the season. They have two season premieres in a year. They're so awesome. They have the season premiere and then the season and a half premiere. After mid-season premiere, yeah. And so it's really cool, and everyone's pumped about it, and I'm really excited. But I've been thinking a lot about the show because I think it's just so brilliant. It's a really brilliant show. And it made me think of something that Jesus says. Let me read you this passage from John chapter 10. I'm just going to go straight to verse 10. Yeah, John 10:10. It says, "The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy." So this is Jesus talking. "The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." So Jesus says, my purpose, my goal, the reason I'm here, my vocation, the mission that I'm on is to bring people life, to bring people to the place where their life is exploding with life. It's like life, full life. And what I found so interesting is Jesus did not say this, like his mission to bring people to life, he didn't say this to dead people. He said it to alive people, which is kind of odd, right? I mean, you would think that if Jesus was coming, or if you hear somebody say that my mission is to bring people to life, well, they must be dealing fundamentally, primarily with dead people. But Jesus here was saying, my mission is to bring people to life who are already alive, but yet they're already dead. What Jesus was really referring to here is that there's really two kinds of death. That there's the death that we all know about, this physical death that we're all kind of aware of. But Jesus was saying, but when you look closer, and when you really begin to see life, you can recognize that there's also another kind of death. There's the kind of death that will infect life. There's the kind of death that is like an infestation that can destroy the quality and the beauty of the life that you're living. And so what I found so fascinating about The Walking Dead, what I love about this show, is that it has a twist on the zombie show, kind of the normal zombie show thing. So those of you who are zombie show people, you're gonna know this, and you've probably spotted it right away. And you're like, oh. And we've talked before about how sometimes producers and storytellers, when they're telling a story that's kind of a cultural story, there's something that they will usually twist to make that story really have an impact and to make it more relevant. And that's what the creators of The Walking Dead did. I don't know if some of you guys noticed it. And that's why it has swept the nation by storm, because of one little twist that they made. And here's what it is. Major, you know, I'm giving away the secrets here. So if you're going to get into this, you're going to, so pause the podcast if you're listening to it. I just want you guys to know. But every other zombie show that's ever been out there, the zombie virus has always been introduced by the bite of the zombie, right? If you get bitten, you become a zombie. That's the whole thing of zombie shows. I mean, if the zombies are coming, if you get bitten, you're going to become one of them. And so the virus is always introduced externally. But in The Walking Dead, they have this twist, and it's brilliant. What they say in The Walking Dead is that we're all already infected, right? You've seen, you remember that, like, this was at the last episode of season 2, I think, is where they kind of said, no, everyone's already infected with this virus. So the disease, the sickness, is already inside of us. So what's so brilliant about The Walking Dead, this series, is that what they're doing is they're saying the struggle, the fight, really isn't about this thing that's out there, external. Really, we're fighting with ourselves. What we're fighting against, like, see, we are already a zombie. When we die, we simply become what we already are. Death is just a vehicle that transforms us into what we already were always anyway. The zombie is us. That's the brilliance of this show. That's what they're doing that's differently. They're saying that really our struggle is not with something out there. Our struggle, really, we're fighting against ourselves, aren't we? In essence, we're fighting against ourselves. Paul picks up on this, and he says the exact same thing in Romans. Let me read this to you, chapter 7, verse 18. Paul says, I know that nothing good lives in me, that is, in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. And hasn't that been the story of our lives? I mean, hasn't that been what your existence has been all about, that you were trying to do something good, you desired something better for yourself, you wanted to be in a better relationship, you wanted to see your marriage improve, you wanted to see your grades improve, you wanted to study harder or to be better or to overcome these addictions, you wanted it. Like, it wasn't that you didn't know what you needed, it wasn't that you didn't desire what you needed to desire. Yet there was something inside of you. It was like this infection. There was something inside of you that we all have this drive that makes us act against our own self-interest. We have this thing inside of us that pushes us towards choices and compels us towards decisions that will ruin and destroy our own lives. Sigmund Freud taught about this, you know, thousands of years, well, 1900s, so 1900 years after Christ. But Sigmund Freud, the father of modern psychology, right? And I know a lot of his, you know, if you're into the field, a lot of his theories and stuff have kind of been debunked in recent years. But he's considered the father of modern psychology, right? Maybe one of the few people who have ever known and understood the mind of man as well as Freud did. And Freud talks about this thing that he called the death drive. And the death drive is this thing inside of all of us that pushes us towards these decisions that destroy our own life. It's our tendency to choose things that actually are going to hurt us. But we choose them. We elect them. It's like we hold on to our past bitterness, even though it's still painful. Like, really, everything about evolution, everything that just about, if our life was simply about just pursuing what was best for us, we would let go of those pains. But yet, we tend to hold on to them and rehearse them over and over. And scientists and psychologists really can give us no explanation for why we do this, because it would behoove our lives to let it go, but we don't. If Freud called it the death drive, Paul says it's this sinful nature, but it's this thing inside of us that pushes us towards decisions that will haunt us. And so we choose bitterness instead of move towards forgiveness. It's the tendency, the way that we do. We will work insane hours to achieve a paycheck that we never enjoy. Because we'll destroy our marriage, we will alienate our children, we'll have a life that is just obsessed by work, but yet there'll be something inside of us that compels us towards that. We will see all around us our relationships crumbling. We'll see it, and we will know that we need to step in. We will see our finances, and we'll see that we'll be standing in the checkout line knowing this is a bad decision, but yet there'll be something inside of us that compels us towards this. The virus is in us. The sickness, the zombie, the disease is inside of us already. And so our transformation is, we're talking now in this series about how can we move past our past? How can we live the beautiful life that God has imagined for us? Our transformation and our renewal is about dealing with and about defeating this truth about us. It's about moving beyond this evil truth that we sometimes intentionally walk down paths that are harmful for us. And here's the question, but how do we do it, right? I mean, how do we do it? Because we tried willpower. A lot of times I think when you go to church, it really is not much more than a self-help seminar. It's some good advice. It's some encouragement. It's a couple upbeat songs and a charismatic speaker who can try to, you know, to prop you up so that you can make it through another week. And really, we've all tried willpower. We've tried just to force ourselves to gut it out and just to be better. And it hasn't worked. We've read this, and we've tried self-help books. You've sat down across the table with a best friend over a cup of coffee and just poured your heart out. And yet you are still compelled to the same thing. See, sometimes our renewal, our transformation is completely dependent upon our ability to move past the destructive nature that's inside of our souls. So how can we unleash this power of new creation? You know, Paul, when we talked that, when Paul uses that word of new creation, he's talking about Genesis, the creation of the universe, the same power that voiced the stars into existence. How can that power be unleashed inside of our souls so that we can live transformed lives? How can we change? Well, Jesus tells a story of a guy very much like us. It's in Luke chapter 15. So if you have your Bibles, turn there. And we've talked about this before. I would really believe that this is the high point of Jesus' teaching ministry. He tells this parable, and he was a master storyteller. Today, if Jesus was alive today, I think that he'd be making like feature films. He would be telling stories and making movies and communicating these truths, because he was a masterful at telling a story to make a point. And so I think this is the best story that he tells. And it's a story that we've studied so several times, many of you have heard. It's the story of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. But it tells the story of a guy very much like us. And I think I'm going to start reading in verse 11. So let me just tell you, just for the sake of time, let me tell you what's happening. There's a father and he has two sons, and his younger son comes to him and says, "Dad, I don't want to be your son anymore. As a matter of fact, I want you to give me your inheritance as if you were dead, and then I want to go my own way." And so the father brokenheartedly gives the son his part of the inheritance, and he goes off and sets off in his world. He denies his father, denies his family, and goes his own way. And so he goes out into all the world, and Jesus, in his story, says he wastes all of his money on partying and just kind of wild living, and he ends up broken. He ends up at the bottom of the barrel. You know, he is at the end of his rope, and he realizes that he had wasted it and all that he had. But in this place, he wakes up in the pig pen. Like, he was feeding pigs. He was working as a servant, just feeding pigs, and he was realizing he was so hungry, he wished that he even had food like the pigs were eating. Now, to me and you, we're like, that sounds terrible, you know, but to a good Jew, that your life has ended up, that you're feeding pigs, and you wish that you could just eat as good as them, I mean, to a Jew, this was absolutely the lowest of the low. I mean, Jesus was trying to tell us that this guy had went all the way down the bottom. He was in the gutter, the end of his rope. Nothing could be worse. They could, literally to a Jew, they could not imagine an existence lower than feeding pigs. Pigs are considered unclean, and so they were vile, disgusting. They were abhorred by the Jewish culture. And so this is where the story kind of picks up. He's in the pig pen. And I'm going to go to verse number 11. It says, let me actually go to verse number 17. Skip down to 17. Is that going to be a problem? Oh, no, you're awesome. It says, when he came to his senses, he said, now this is talking about the son. So when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants," I love that he didn't even reply to his son. He just said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger." The ring would be the family signet ring, signifying that this is my son. And so he put the signet ring back on his finger, and sandals on his feet. "Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. I love the story. Jesus tells us a story about a young man whose bad decisions had led to devastating consequences in his life. Sounds familiar, right? Because if it's not you, well, you're probably lying. But if it's not you, it's certainly somebody that you know, right? We've all been in that situation where we've lived out the fact that our own choices, our own propensity towards destruction has created for us some hot water. And so Jesus tells us a story about this young man who wakes up in the pig pen. And you know, what I found so fascinating in my study is that we all know that Jews consider pigs to be an unclean animal. They weren't allowed to eat them. But pigs are not the only unclean animal in the Jewish culture. In the Jewish religion, and according to Old Testament law, there were two things that an animal had to do to be considered clean. One, they had to have a split hoof. Two, they had to chew their cud. And so they had to basically be an herbivore. And so like a cow with a split hoof, chews his cud, that's a clean animal. But pigs were not one. But there were other unclean animals. But pigs were especially forbidden by Jews. And the rabbis had wrote extensively in the Talmud about this, that the pigs were abhorred by the Jews. As a matter of fact, a Jew could own other unclean animals. You could own them as long as they were not for food purposes. So like a horse, they're considered unclean. So as long as you're not going to eat it, no big deal, which just works out good because not a lot of people want to eat a horse, but they're great for like other things. And so but pigs, a Jew is not even allowed to own. They couldn't own them, they couldn't work for them, they couldn't tend to them, and they certainly could not eat them or use them for sacrifice. The reason, though, for a pig is because pigs do have a split hoof, but they don't chew their cud. And so to the Jews, they were like a half-breed. They were like it was like hypocrisy. They were almost, but not really, clean animals. And so to the Jews, they represented the fact that they were kind of like the Samaritans in a lot of ways. They were kind of half-breeds, and so they were just especially poor because one thing the Jew could not stand was hypocrisy. And so this is why the pigs were especially forbidden, just a little background information. That was probably way too much. You're like, yeah, I didn't even care. No, I thought that was interesting. But anyway, so here's the thing. This guy, he wakes up in this situation. He's at the bottom, and he's feeding pigs. He's living with the pigs. He is covered in the pig's mess. But in this moment, he knew he had to change. And what is so beautiful about this young man is he has this awakening. I mean, there comes a time in our spiritual journey where we have this awakening, doesn't it? And he recognized that he needed to live differently. He was willing at this point, all of a sudden, because of this awakening that he had in his soul, he was willing to deny some things that he had formerly approved of. And he was willing to submit to some things that he had formerly rebelled against. And so there was this transformation about him, and he recognized that he had to change, that's a huge step. Just recognizing that I have to take responsibility for my actions, that I have to realize that where I am is not because of where I was born or how I was raised or what happened to me couple years back or what the person did that went wrong to me. I'm not a product of what people did to me. I'm a product of the choices that I have made and how I've responded. And so he has this moment where he recognizes that he was willing to change. And listen to what he says. He says, I'm no longer worthy to be a son. Make me like a servant. Make me like a servant to his father. In other words, the young man thinks he thought he would try religion. He thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to go back to my father, but I'm not going to be his son. I'm just going to be like a slave. Maybe he'll just accept me if I just try religious. Maybe what I'm going to do, if I just do what I'm supposed to do, if I'm just a good boy, if I come when he says come, and I go when he says to go, and I do what he says to do, he says this is how I'm going to relate now. He used to be my father, but now he's going to be my taskmaster. I used to be his child, but now I'm just going to be his slave. And so he decides that he's going to try a religious type relationship with his father. He's going to go back and just do the right things because he has to. And I love what the father does. The father, you notice in the story, he doesn't even consider it. He doesn't even look, didn't even speak to his son. He just looks at the servants and he says, go and get a ring and put it on his finger and get a robe and kill the fattened calf and bring out the best that we have. We're going to celebrate. He immediately treated him like the son that he always was. See, I think when it comes to our transformation and the spiritual journey that we all are on, that we have a choice between religion and relationship. We have to choose between that. And so many times we often turn to religion when God is calling us to sonship or to daughterhood. We want to come to God and we want to serve him because we think we have to. We've got to do the right things. And I don't really want to give it up, but I've got to give it up. And I don't really want to live this way, but I've got to do it because that's what God says. Or we just kind of go the opposite way and we say, well, I ain't going to do it. You know, sorry, God, about you. But we have this very religious type way that we want to relate to God. And we think that our transformation only happens when we start doing things correctly. So we have this thought that says, man, you know what, if I want my life to change, my transformation is not going to happen until I start, you know, I get myself up out of this pig pen. And so I'm going to live right, I'm going to do right. And so we try really hard and we fail. And we come to church and we say, I'm sorry, and we try again and we fail. And pretty soon we just get overwhelmed with our own failure because we've chosen religion. We've chosen to come back to our father like a slave. I love what it says here in verse 17. I'm going to put verse 17 back up. It says, when he came to his senses. So he's in the pig pen and he has this awakening. He has that moment of enlightenment. Something inside of his soul, just like finally it all clicked. Some of you have had that. Most of you have had that moment where all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute. I'm destined for more than this. And he has this moment. But I love here what the translator says as when he came to his senses. And I think, I was like, thank you, the translators, for kind of helping us to understand the passage. But in all honesty, that's not what this says at all. And really, there's no debate between scholars what it actually says. In the Greek, it doesn't say he came to his senses. The word for senses is the reflexive third-person pronoun, which I know you're like, what's that mean? It means it would be translated himself. And a lot of translations just say when he came to himself. But that's a little odd to go when he came to himself. And so they like try to help us out, to help us understand the story, and they translate it when he came to his senses. But I find it very, very interesting that what Jesus actually said was that he came to himself. In other words, there's a moment on your spiritual journey where you have this awakening, and all of a sudden you realize, I am not who I was meant to be. The life that I'm living doesn't fit the life that I've imagined or the life that God has imagined for me. Haven't you had that moment? Some of you have experienced this. Like you were in the middle of a relationship, and you loved him, and you had all these feelings, but yet you just knew that there was more. And you were tired of going through all the pain, and you were tired of all the frustration that went with it. And yeah, you had all this baggage, and yeah, you had this past with this person. Maybe they were the person that had been with you since, you know, junior high, or maybe they were the father of your kids. But yet, haven't you had that moment where you said, wait a minute, there's more. God, there's, and you came to yourself, like you saw who you were supposed to be, clearly, like for the first time. Some of you were in a job, and you were just going through this mundane, do it every day, and you had this moment of introspection, and all of a sudden, it was like a light inside of your soul, and you came to yourself, and you said, wait a minute, I was created for a destiny and for a purpose, and you recognize that you were more. See, in this story, I love that Jesus said that he was in the pig pen, but it says that he was hungry. He was hungry. He said, man, if I just could eat what these pigs were eating. He said, in other words, he was hungry for more. Jesus said that he longed for more. He desired this transformation. And the prodigal son did not become like his father by becoming a servant, but only by living like a son. So Jesus said that there was this recognition inside of him. And so he goes to his father, and his father recognizes, he says, listen, I'm not going to accept you back as my servant. Your transformation will never be complete just because you're doing the right things. Your transformation will never take root inside of your soul because you religiously, because of your own standards, because of your high willpower, because you've got a good sense of discipline. Your transformation will never work because you're doing the right things. Only when you start living like the Son. Only when you see who you were created to be. And so he realized who he was. He realized who he was created to be. See, the prodigal son's transformation happened by living like his father, not through serving his father. And that's the beautiful twist on the story. This is what Jesus did that was completely would blow the mind of the people. Because they knew all about what you're supposed to do when you had fallen away. Like if you were a good Jew and you had denied your father and ended up in a pig pen, there were rules, there were regulations, there were ways that you had to go about restoring that brokenness. And Jesus said, no, well, here's what he did. He just went back and accepted that he was a son, that he was always a son. Our transformation is a process of becoming like God and living like God. That's really the pursuit that we're on. Spirituality, if you boil it down to its basic, it's coming to ourselves, recognizing who we always were, and beginning to live like that, beginning to live like a son, beginning to live like a daughter. Becoming like God, looking like God, acting like God. And look what his father says when he does this. Put up verse 24. Look what his father says. I think it's brilliant. He says, this son of mine who was dead is alive again. The son of mine. Hear what he says? My son. This is my son. In other words, you know what he was saying? He says, you are not a servant. You are not my slave. You are my daughter. You are my son. You have always been my son. He didn't say, well, now since you come back, now you can be my son again. Listen, he said, my son who was dead, heaven forbid that this would ever happen to any of us, but if we had a child, if you had a child that died, would they ever stop becoming your son because they had died? No, absolutely not. So you don't stop becoming a child simply because that you're dead, because you died. So in other words, death does not make you less a son or a daughter. It only makes you less alive. That's what it does. It makes you less alive. And so Jesus said, I've come to give you life. You've always been my child. You've always been my daughter. You've always been my girl. You've always been my boy. See, transformation is becoming alive. It's about becoming alive again, not about becoming a son again. And so many times in religious circles, we get that all twisted up. We think that the purpose and the process of our spirituality is somehow to please God so that he will accept us again, to do the right things, to get God off of our back, to make God happy, to please him. In other words, God wants to change the way we live, not so that we can please him, but so that we can live better. That's what this is about. God wants us to live better. He wants us to live up to the life that he has imagined for us. He wants us to come to ourselves and to see who we were created to be. And so when we try to live better just to please God, just because we think that's what God expects of us, just because we have some religious ideology that says that if we don't do the certain things, God's going to be angry, when we try to live that way, we just fail over and over. And you've experienced that. Hasn't that been your story? I mean, we just fail over and over and over. Our transformation, our renewal doesn't happen because we serve God, but only when we live like a son or daughter of God. That's when our transformation happens, when we absorb this mission that says, I want to start living like a son. I want to start living like a daughter because that's who I am. You know, really what we're talking about, and this is maybe a little bit of a different perspective and different take on it, but traditionally, theologically, this has always been referred to as holiness. But holiness is one of those words, right? Because as soon as I say holiness, we all get a different image, right? Some of you think of, you know, skirts that are dragging the ground. Others of you thinking about, I was going to ask you a question. What do you think of when you hear the word holiness? But I'm not sure we want to hear some of these stories because depending on the perspective you're from, you've got some really good or some really, really bad perspectives on that. But really what we're talking about traditionally has been referred to as with the word of holiness, this act or the sense, the state of becoming like God. This all stems in the Jewish culture from their understanding of the Old Testament, but from one key passage, and it's in the book of Leviticus chapter 19. So let's read Leviticus 19 verse 2 together. This is kind of the center place. Jews quote this. They memorize this. This is part of their prayers, their daily prayers. This is in Leviticus 19. It says, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Holy sounds like a very spiritual word, right? We got the Holy Bible, got the Holy Spirit, got holy water, you know, and you got holy crap, you know, I don't know, there's all kinds of holy, if you're in India, you got holy cows, I don't know. But holiness sounds like this very, very spiritual word, and we know the word, but I wonder, do we really know what the word means? Because we always tend to think of holiness in terms of religious obligation, right? The things that we must do. It's about obeying. It's about conforming. It's about submitting. It's about serving. And this type of living can often destroy our soul, not unleash it, right? I mean, it's just living that way where you're constantly trying to please God and feeling like a failure can often destroy the very work that we're seeking to build and what God is seeking to want to do. And so perhaps there's more to holiness. What if we have missed it? And so what I want to do, and this is going to take a few moments, but I want to just read to you, and I was going to do the whole chapter of Leviticus 19, but I'm just going to do just the first 19 verses, about half this chapter, because I wanted to give us a sense of in the Jewish concept of what holiness was. And really, it's all the book of Leviticus. It's all the Old Testament. We've talked before that they had 613 laws, mitzvah, that they would try to keep every day. And these are just a few of them, but I want to give you a sense of what Old Testament God spoke and what holiness is about. So the Lord said to Moses, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Each of you must respect his mother and father, and you must observe my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols or make gods of cast metal for yourselves. I am the Lord your God. Verse 5, when you sacrifice a fellowship offering to the Lord, sacrifice it in such a way that it will be accepted on your behalf. It shall be eaten on the day you sacrifice it or the next day. Anything left over until the third day must be burned up. If any of it is eaten on the third day, it is impure and will not be accepted. Whoever eats it will be held responsible because he has desecrated what is holy to the Lord. That person must be cut off from his people. So very deeply spiritual, dealing with ritual and sacrifice. Verse 9, when you reap the harvest of your land, so now he's talking about farming, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time to pick up the grapes that have fallen. So in their time, remember, they didn't have like combines that made nice little neat rows. They would do their best to break up the soil. They would sow seed by hand. And one of the laws of holiness, one of the laws here of how to be holy was, listen, just don't take all of it. Just don't go over your field a second time, harvest it once, but leave the rest of it. And here's why. It says, leave them for the poor and the alien I am the Lord your God. And so in one of the commands that's not in this passage is that the Jews were commanded. It says, listen, when you have aliens, and they're not talking about people from Mars, they're talking about foreigners in the land, so people who were not native Israelites, but yet because they had been displaced from their home, had become to live. And so they were commanded that you accept them, that you welcome into your community, and you treat them as part of the family. So the Jews were said, listen, don't harvest your field a second time. Don't even take the edges, and don't take the gleanings, which meant don't pick up the things that you dropped on the ground when you harvest by hand. You leave all of that for poor people and for the aliens, or for the foreigners in the land. Then it's verse 11, do not steal, do not lie, do not deceive one another. Verse 12, do not swear falsely by my name and so profane the name of your Lord God, I am the Lord. 13, do not defraud your neighbor or rob him. Do not hold back the wages of a hired man overnight. So now he's talking about business. He's talking about how you pay your people on time. Verse 14, do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God, I am the Lord. Historians tell us this is really one of the first times that really equality for those with various disabilities was mentioned. And so one of the commands of the Old Testament was that you not put up a stumbling block for people with disabilities, that you actually make a way for them to participate in the rest of the culture of the community. Where do we leave off? 15, you say? 15, do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly. Verse 16, do not go about spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Verse 18, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge. Verse 19, keep your decrees. Do not mate different kinds of animals. Do not plant your field with two different kinds of seeds. Do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And really what you get a sense from when you read the Old Testament law is that holiness was very, very earthy. You know what I mean? That holiness was about the grit, the grime, the everydayness of life. Like, we tend to think of holiness as this super spiritual, like, whoa, I'm going to be holy. And, you know, those people who come and kind of fluttering in, and, you know, they're just like kind of, and they're doing all these weird things, and they, you know, I don't know. I mean, and we think of holiness in that way, right? Like, oh, those people, they must be really, really holy, when really we're saying they're really kind of really, really weird. Because holiness in the Bible was really much about the dirt. It was about the grit. It was about real life. And what we learn here is the path to holiness isn't ethereal and otherworldly, but it's practical and pragmatic. It's about everyday life. It's not about hermits and caves and monks and monasteries, but it's about self-restraint, and it's about discipline, and it's about honesty, and it's about decency. And these are the issues of holiness. What I found so beautiful about this passage is that the same passage that tells us to keep the Sabbath holy, which is one of, if not the most sacred command in all of Scripture, to keep the Sabbath holy. To Jews, that was to desecrate the Sabbath. That's why they crucified Jesus, because they continued to keep desecrating the Sabbath from their perspective. I mean, this was so fundamental to who they were. But the same passage that gives us this way of being holy also instructs us to keep honest weights and measures in our shop, and to pay our employees on time, and not to lie. And it talks about how our eating and our working and our parenting and our sexuality and our generosity, and it just talks about all these areas of life. I mean, this is all what it means to be holy. In other words, to become holy, we must pay attention to God in every area of our life. And that's the beauty of living as a son or daughter. That's the beauty of pursuing this life change, is it brings the reality of God down to every morsel, every element, every part of our day-to-day life. In other words, nothing is meaningless. And sometimes we have this tendency to compartmentalize our life, and we have spiritual things over here and non-spiritual things over there. And what holiness is about pursuing God in every area of my life. It's about paying attention to God. We say all the time at Dialogue that everything is spiritual. That there is not, that this divide between secular and sacred is completely a farce, that all of life is spiritual life. And so holiness is about bridging the gap. It's learning to be aware of God in every moment, learning how to use the physical reality of my day-to-day existence right now, and recognizing that this can connect me to God, that God is here. He's tangible. He's physical. It's about celebrating the connection between my physical reality and my spiritual existence. See, holiness is a way to imbue all of life with the conscious presence of God. See, if you're one of those people that sometimes feel distant from God, and if you're one of those ones that sometimes think, man, I need to get to Sunday. If I could just get to Sunday where I can come in and be refreshed. Listen, you need to begin to pursue holiness. Holiness is this pathway where we say, I want every choice that I make, every decision of my life, every relationship that I have, I want to use it all to connect to God so that God becomes a part of my material existence in every moment. See, and I think we've got it wrong because holiness has then often just been kind of demoted to mean, or misunderstood to mean, separation from evil. Like, I've just got to stay away from bad things. That's what holiness is. It's just about all the things I say no to. No, I'm not going to do this, not going to do that. And really, we've missed the point because this is about embracing all of life as a pathway to the sacred. It's really, holiness is about saying everything that I do, say, every interaction I have is a pathway where I can encounter God. And so, in other words, holiness is saying these choices matter. This life matters. Today matters. How I'm going to live matters. The morality that I live by at work matters, because all of life becomes a pathway to the sacred, a pathway to God. I think that when we learn how to live in this path of holiness, what we're really doing is opening the door for God to imbue all of our life, at home, at work, at play, at school. All of life becomes imbued with the presence of God. So we kind of end where we began, John chapter 10, verse 10. Jesus says, I've come that you might have life, life to the full, a different, a new, a hitherto unimaginable type of life, a life that is so full of life, it's overcomes the death that's inside of you. It just spills out of you. It falls out of you, rolls out of somewhere deep inside of your soul. See, I believe that God wants us to live holy because he wants us to live better. He wants us to live holy because he wants us to enjoy and to participate and to take part in this full life. And so the choices that we make, and some things that we elect not to do, and some things we say, listen, I need to make this a regular part of my life. It's not because we're trying to please God. It's not because I'm trying to, you know, make him accept me as a son. But it's that I want to live like a daughter. I want to live like a son so my transformation can be complete. See, holiness isn't about avoiding the things that make God mad. It's about discovering ways to enjoy God in every moment. Holiness is living aware that all of life is spiritual and drenched in the presence of God. Worship team, if you guys would go ahead and come back up. So would you guys stand with me as we wrap up today? Leviticus chapter 19, verse 2. That command that's become so central to the thought, to the religious expression of the Jewish community. God says, be holy because... You guys are... Go ahead and mute everything so they can plug in and then unmute them. Sorry. That's always a real... I'll wake you up. All right. Now back to being serious. What was I talking about? I have no idea what I was saying. Amen. You guys are dismissed. No, oh, Leviticus 19. Thank you, man. She reminds me. So in this passage, it's so central to their thought and their mindset. God says, be holy because I am holy. And what I find fascinating, I was doing some reading this week. Like I said, the rabbis have written extensively about this in the Talmud. There's just been a lot of years, thousands of years of reflection upon what does it mean to be holy because I, the Lord, am holy. And what the rabbis say is that this is a command. What most of us receive it as is, be holy because I'm holy. It's like I say, you know, I said it, you do it. But the rabbi said this is not simply a command. This is a command, but it's also a possibility. The rabbi says that we can be holy, you know, God, as God has commanded, but we can be holy because God is holy. So it's that God wasn't necessarily justifying why we should be holy because he's holy, but he was saying you can be holy because I am holy. In other words, what God was really saying here is he said, listen, because of who I am and because of the Father that I am, you can live this life. You can live like a son because of who I am and because of the transparency and the realness of the way that I live inside of you. You can actually allow that life to live through you. You can do that. We can live in such a way that the image of God that's inside of us is unencumbered by the choices that we make and the decisions that we choose. We can allow the truth of who we are to come out. And we can do it. Not because of our willpower, not because of our strength, not because of we just prayed really hard, not because we came up to the altar and we made a bunch of promises to God. We can do it because he is holy. Because of who he is, we can be who he's imagined us to be. Would you close your eyes? Father, is there a place in our life where the virus, where the sickness is just living inside of us? Lord, maybe even this morning, some of us here are having that moment of awakening, that place where we come to the realization that we're living right now in the pig trough, and we're covered with all of the muck and all of the filth, and our own own choices have brought destruction into our lives. And maybe even this morning, God, we're here and we're just waking up to the fact that we're not living like the son. We're not living like a daughter. Maybe we're just here today, and maybe you're here and you just need to say, Father, I want to come back to you as your child. And I want to live like you, not to please you, not as a servant, but as a son, as a daughter. Is that you? Do you just need to hear just this morning and say, God, in my heart and in my soul, I want to start living better. Maybe you've recognized that the transformation that you seek is a dependent primarily upon the choices that you make. And just right now you say, God, if you will enable me, God, if you will allow me, if I can do this because of who you are, then I want to make that commitment to you this morning. And if that's you today, will you just take a moment and just say, God, I want to live different. I want to live better. I want to follow hard after you. You know, perhaps there's someone else here that for you, you've been being obedient. You've been doing the right thing. You've been trying to please God. Maybe you've been doing that for as long as you can remember. And you've been so caught up in serving him that sometimes, just for a moment, maybe sometimes you kind of forget that you're not his servant, you're his daughter. You're not a slave, you're a son. Sometimes maybe you see other people and they're doing things that you know are wrong, and they're making choices that you know will destruct their lives, and you look at them and you have this thing that rises up inside of you, and you get so frustrated, and you just maybe need to remember that they're a son, they're a child. They're just like us. They're just like you. Maybe today you just need to say, God, I want to come to you as your child this morning. And if that's you today, as we sing this song, will you allow that grace of God just to fall down in your life and to bring refreshing? Let's sing this together.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Amazing love, now flowing down from hands and feet that were nailed to a tree. Grace flows down to Calvary's knee. Covers me.
Cry out to him and allow it to cover you. God, cover us this morning, God. Fall down on us. Grace like rain, Father.
Covers me.
Yeah. Father, allow your reign to come. Come to us like a gentle, restoring, renewing rain. And Lord, that rain soak down into our souls this morning. Let your grace, let mercy seep to the very core and the fiber of who we are. And it will begin to nourish us, transforming us into the image of your Son, to the image of who we were created to be. May we come to ourselves this morning. May we serve you like a son. And now may you be blessed. May you come to that moment of awakening where you see yourself how God sees you. May you become everything God has imagined you to be. And on your journey, may you live by faith, be known for love, and be a voice of hope. Love you guys. See you next week.